It's May 11th, Masoret. We're addressing ourselves to a book that somebody wrote about education and the utilization of rewards, claiming that it's not a good idea to use rewards in education, in stimulating children to study, to learn, and grow, etc. So we're addressing ourselves to that. We'll start with the second reason. This is Jesse's summarization. Rewards discourage risk-taking. And this is Jesse speaking. I am finding this to be something I hadn't thought about and quite intriguing. What exactly is the person does exactly, what exactly, the person does exactly what is necessary to get their reward and no more. It puts students into thinking inside a box rather than thinking outside the box. The objective is not to succeed at the task, the objective is to get the reward. He cites studies that preschoolers, grade schoolers, and adults working for rewards try to avoid anything challenging. All right, two quotes. The lesson is that school is not about playing with ideas or taking intellectual risks. It is about doing what is necessary and only what is necessary to snag a better letter or number. Most students will quickly accommodate us choosing to do that which will maximize the grade and not attempting tasks in which they might fail, even though they would choose to challenge themselves to a greater degree under other circumstances. And if anything deserves to be called natural, it is the tendency to seek optimal challenge, to struggle to make sense of the world, to fool around with unfamiliar ideas. Human beings are inclined to push themselves to succeed at something moderately difficult. Number five, perhaps the most deadly, and I'm actually noticing that it is true, rewards cut the interest rate. He quotes studies that people's interest in what they are doing typically declines when they are rewarded for doing it. He has an entire chapter devoted to this. Extremely convincing. All right, we'll pause here. Well, let's ask a question. Why do people give rewards altogether? How did it get started? What's the purpose of rewards in the first place? Here's the real problem. If you're going to have rewards one way or another. Unless you're talking about some Garden of Eden, the assumption is that you are asking the child to do something that in and of itself he wouldn't want to do. He has no desire to do this thing in and of itself. Now, if you have a way of making education, of teaching, here's what I would agree. If you have a way of educating people in a manner that they'll really, really enjoy and they'll be happy to do it, just as you don't need to reward a kid for playing ball. You could use that as an example. You open up a playground with swings, with the basketball courts, with a pool, and you take the kid there every day. You're not going to have to reward him. However, if instead of just opening up the park, let's use that example, and say just do whatever you want to do, let's say that no, we were going to give you lessons in playing tennis because we want you to play correctly, so that you're not just going to go there and take a racket and hit the ball and just have fun, but we want you to learn how to grip it properly, and we want you to learn a swing, a backhand, and do it the right way. Now, this involves a lot of things which goes against the grain of the kid. It's tedious, it's annoying, it's boring. So that's going to be a completely different picture. Then the question will be, how do you go against the resistance of the child and get him involved in an activity that he doesn't want to do? That's my point. Now, I'll agree with a person that, but there's nothing to agree with, because if we're talking about getting the child involved in things where he's going to enjoy it and want to do it, because he wants to do it, because it's fun, because he likes to do it, so then I would agree with him. And ideally, if you had a way of making the education fun and in line with the natural instincts of the child, that would be the ideal thing. However, if you don't have such a thing, and I don't know of anybody who's developed that kind of a method, and certainly in a manner which, you know, you can have a system based on it, where you got, you could take a kid out into the woods, a couple of kids that like the outdoors, and make it a learning experience that they'll have fun with. But, I mean, to set up a school, and a system, and covering ground, and so on and so forth, is clearly going to be contrary to the natural instincts of the child, then I'll ask you a question. What's going to be the motivation? What are you going to use for an incentive? So if you take away the word rewards and say, fine, you don't like rewards, I will ask you, rewards are serving a purpose. The purpose of the rewards is to create the incentive. Thus, you have two kinds of incentives, positive and negative. The negatives are the punishments, whatever you want to, the loss of privileges, whatever it is. Every school will have their consequences. There must be consequences. And the other ones are positive. The positive ones we call rewards. And they're not necessarily, they're not going to be the reward of the learning itself. They're going to be extraneous rewards in the form of grades, in the form of gifts, whatever it may be. So, what I'm saying is, this is the problem, that rewards, the issue of rewards comes into being because it is an impossibility to have an educational system which the child will naturally want to engage in because it's fun. And thus, you're going to have to use motivation. And those motivations, sooner or later, will intersect with the idea of rewards. There's a lot of tedium involved. Learning is fun and all of that, that's true. But not all aspects of learning are fun. And even to get to the fun, to get to the point where you can enjoy it as fun, it takes a lot of work. You have to learn certain skills and so on and so forth. So there must be a commitment. This is true with adults as well. When adults first begin to study, you know, people come to Masoret, whatever it is. At first it's, they don't necessarily enjoy it that much or find it that interesting, whatever. You know, it takes a lot of training. It's cultivation. The joy of learning takes cultivation. Of course, you can make it a contest. You could ask questions. Kids like questions, so on and so forth. That's a limited kind of thing. But there's not enough of that to make every aspect of the learning fun. So what's needed is discipline. That is, the child has to be disciplined to do things that in and of itself he doesn't want to do. Now, how are you going to get the child to do it? Now, it may be good, I would say as follows, that the more you can rely on non-material rewards, the fact that the child has a good relationship with the parent, wants to please the parent, wants to compliment, whatever it is, that's probably better. Yeah, obviously, if you bear in mind another thing, that this is a huge mistake. This is a huge mistake that he's making. Because don't confuse, this is the kind of thing that's subject to abuse. Because the proper utilization of rewards, I'm saying, is absolutely necessary. However, the improper, you can get a lot of negative results. The kinds of results he's getting is not a reflection on the idea of rewards. It's a reflection on the way it's being used in those situations, in those circumstances. And obviously, you could set up a thing where a system where let me add one further element. If the only thing you're using is the reward, what he's saying is like this. So a person, he's taking it to an extreme case. You have a job to do, which is a painful job. All right, we have to clear out the rocks from the backyard. Okay, so you get a reward if you do it. So, okay, fine, I'll do it for the reward. I need the money. So then I'm going to find out, well, what's the minimal? Of course I'm not going to do more than the minimal, because I have no other reason to want to do it. That's, if you set up something like that, that's what's going to happen. But that's not the way it should work. Because the reward should not be the essence of the thing. Let me just give you, I'll put out all my ideas on the table, then you can attack me. The Rambam talks about mitoch shelo lishma bo lishma. He says it's absolutely necessary to use rewards. Absolutely, because when a child, I don't have it in front of me. Perhaps we can do it. The hakdama. No. What is it? Is it, where does the Rambam write about the rewards? Is that mamar tchias amesim, or is that in the hakdama to chelek? In one of his hakdamos. Well, perhaps the Mamar. He talks about this. Now I'm thinking it's Chalik. Whatever. And he says when a kid is very little, you know, you tempt him to do the lesson and you'll get the candy. Now, he says, of course, this is a terrible thing. The reason why he holds it's a terrible thing is not because of the reasons of this book. It's because you're making the candy the good, and the learning is the is just a means. But he says there's no way that the child can understand that. You can't tell the child the real reason. Study Torah because Torah is the greatest activity. Then he says as he gets older, so he outgrows the candy. It no longer works. So you get him something more sophisticated. A toy. And then as he gets older, he likes clothing. And so on and so forth. And then he says, learn, so you'll get honor. Now, when you're telling a person learn to get honor, that's already an advanced person. So you see how powerful the instincts are, and all this is considered to be lo lishma. And he says, it's a disgraceful thing, because you're implying that the real reason for learning is not the learning, but rather in order to get something else. Of course the question arises, if that's the case, well, how does it work? Now, I think it means, the way I understand rewards, where will it produce the result that he's talking about? That is, the person will just do the minimal necessary to get the reward. Okay? First of all, let me mention two things of it. I want to mention this also. You have to mention this also, because if the reward is geared that way, that I'll give you the reward, if you're talking about an activity where a person can do the minimal and get away with it, so then that's not an intelligent use of the reward. For example, when I had a system of rewards, I had a system like this. I have my experiment. This is years and years ago when I first started teaching. This is back in the early 70s. I just started teaching. I got this job in the middle of the year, whatever it was, and it was one of these schools where the kids were really tough kids. The kids came from non-religious backgrounds. It was like a yeshiva, and they were very, very unruly and rough and whatever. And they had to get rid of one teacher after another. You know, like nobody could control these kids. Very uncontrollable. And for whatever reason, I took the job. And so they started to gang up on me too and make it impossible for me to teach. That's how bad it was. But I was very determined to try and conquer them. So I was thinking of different systems. I set up a system of rewards. I worked it out very, very carefully. That's another thing that's very important. I set up a system. It was a rational system, where each kid had to contribute a certain amount of money. I kept this thing completely secret. Nobody ever knew about it. I told them. And they became, you know, enthralled with the whole idea. And I covered virtually all the areas. Each kid would have to contribute a certain amount of money. So each kid had a stake in it. Okay, say it was 10 cents, 20 cents, whatever. You know, in the 1970s, whatever it was. And it would be like a pool. You know, at the end of the week, the kid with the most points would get the money. I have two prizes. See, there were two groups over there. One was more advanced than the other, so I had to gear it that each student was competitive. And I had a whole system of rules, checks and minuses. The minuses, of course, were for negative behaviors, for calling out, talking of this and that, and you know. And once you get a minus, you lose a point. The one, and how to get a point, was interesting. Now, the getting of the point would be not just, you know, something where you could do the minimum. It meant like asking a good question would get a point. So therefore, they were the incentive, the motivation was to do something to open your mind and to pay attention and to listen. That was unusual. It wasn't just if I asked the question and they gave an answer, what the answer is. I very rarely ask those kinds of questions. So if I asked the question, I said, if you have a good thought, that's a check. That's a good, because you're using it. And then we discuss why it is. Now, it had unbelievable success because it was geared towards forcing them to get involved and to think. It solved all the problems immediately, very, very quickly. There was absolutely no, every kid was enthralled, and I kept it in such a way that it was competitive, and it was a weekly thing. At the end, I reached the point that these kids really became turned on to learning. At the end of the year, I reached a point where they no longer really needed the reward system. They were turned on to learning. But without that reward system in the first place, I could never have created an atmosphere, an environment, and a dialogue. Because you couldn't do the minimum over here. The nature of the reward system was set up so that you couldn't do the minimum. You had to be participating all the time. Now, how would he answer that? What kind of experiment did he do? Did he do an experiment? This is an actual experiment. This is not just theoretics. I took the worst group of kids, and then nobody else could. The parents couldn't believe this. I told the kids, we also had a little conspiracy going. I said, you cannot tell anyone. I knew that they'd go crazy. I'm introducing a pool system, you know, where you pool the monies and everything. They, you know, the parents would have gone crazy, even though it was a great idea. But I didn't expect the educational establishment to be able to be that open-minded. But it worked even more so because the kids now were in on something with me, and we were all sworn to secrecy, so to speak. So suddenly, parents were coming to me and saying, I can't believe it. My kid can't wait to go to school in the morning. I had evoked their competitive emotions, the desire for the prize. And in order to get that, you had to think. Now, had I not discovered a method of overcoming their emotions, their resistances, and then gearing it, as I said, not just the prize. I could have set up a system where it would have encouraged minimalism. You could have a system like that. But that's why I found his arguments ridiculous. Because, yeah, you do an experiment. Well, what? You set up a system. True, if you set up a system with rewards, it means that the activity that you're... The reward is supposed to prompt them to get into the pool, into the swimming pool. The assumption is once they're swimming, they'll discover the enjoyment of swimming. And then they'll want to swim. That's the way it's got to work. That is, it's a catalyst. Rewards have to be used as a catalyst to get the child into those activities, which, if conducted properly, will bring out the natural desire to do these things. He'll experience the enjoyment. Once he experiences the enjoyment, he's going to want it. Now he's going to be in a conflict. He's going to like it. Hey, I'm getting paid to do this. It's like, you know, sometimes a person gets a job they really enjoy. And they can't say, I can't believe it, I'm getting paid to do this. Yeah, but if you stop paying him, he may not want to do it. Sometimes it will be a combination of factors. But the person, for whatever reason, he may not go in if you don't pay him. But when he goes in, he's not doing the minimal because he enjoys the job. The minimalism has to do with the fact that the person is not enjoying what he's doing. So that's a separate problem. That removing the reward is not going to... Removing the reward, because I'll say, because Manashah, even if you don't give a reward, that's not going to cure the problem. He's not going to now want to do those things. He's still going to want to do minimalism. What's going to stop him from doing minimalism is that he's really into it and he's enjoying it. Or he will get a great reward for doing maximalism. But all of that means you need good teaching. So if you have good teaching, which makes it interesting and fine, so then you don't have to worry about minimalism. Then the only question, so then what's hurt, how are you being hurt by the reward? I would say, then, a child who does not have a reward waiting for him, it's just all you have is the activity itself. And a child that has the reward waiting for him, who's going to put more effort and energy into it? The one with the reward. I think that, I don't think it's possible to work without rewards. And to the contrary, if the rewards are used properly, then they have to be targeted. The reward has to be for a certain kind of activity. That is very crucial, and that does not show up on these experiments. It seems like, that's why when I was reading it, I thought it was ridiculous. I mean, obviously, just he's taking reward and making it into the essence and negating everything else. Obviously, reward by itself is not going to produce. You've got to have the good teaching, and you have to have the ability to take an activity which the child doesn't want to do and to make it something which he will discover is really enjoyable. It's like a kid doesn't want to ride a bike. So he's got to be coaxed onto the bike with some reward. But the idea is that once he learns how to ride, it's going to be fun. He's going to want to ride. He won't need the reward anymore. But at a certain point in time, he needed the reward. The whole world works on rewards in terms of athletes. Athletes, basketball, baseball, they all have to get rewards. And even though they love the sport, so that you take away the rewards, you'll see they'll stop playing. But the rewards have to be done intelligently.
That's actually the point, right, man? Because the fact
when you're talking about kids in sports, kids don't need a reward. You shouldn't use a reward if you don't need it. I said that at the outset. Baseball players get rewarded because they're not playing for fun. They're playing to win. It's a business. So to reach that type of level of output and so on and so forth, they need a reward. They're not going to do it. To the contrary, if you're not rewarding them, then they'll just play until they've had enough and they'll leave. They'll stop. The critique that he uses is absurd. The critique applies to his own system. If there's no reward, so a kid will just do it. And when he doesn't have to do it anymore, he'll stop. That's when he'll just do the minimum. You can't motivate him beyond that because there's no motivation. He'll just do the minimum. And then I'll get tired. I'm not in the mood. I'm not going to try harder. Why should I try harder? He's not going to learn how to play tennis the right way. He'll just play. Now, once he gets tired of tennis, he'll stop. He's not going to bother. What do I care if I'm hitting the ball the right way or not the right way? What difference does it make? I'm just having a little fun, and that's it. He won't go very, very far because you're removing incentive. He presupposes that kids have natural incentive to learn more, to grow more, and all the things you want them to do, they naturally have incentive to do, which is absurd. They have no incentive to grow. As people, they have no incentive to get better midos, etc., 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 because all this is not programmed. We have to create the incentives for them. At this stage of the analysis, this was my reaction when I read those notes. I couldn't believe that anybody could write a book like this. I thought it was a joke. The person who doesn't have the reward will just give up when he feels like giving up, because what difference does it make? But the person who has the reward, he wants the World Series, he wants the fame, or the whatever it is. He's going to keep trying, because he wants that reward. Now, the reward is only meaningful if it's something that he really wants. And he can't have it unless he does something really what we want him to do. That's an intelligent reward. That is, you structure, it's got to be something he really, really wants. And it's got to be something that he can't have, cannot have. Unless, then you got a good reward system. But again, take that away, what is going to motivate the child? The child, in my opinion, basically has no incentives. There's no incentive for a child. A child just wants to play. And a child just wants to follow his instinct. And a child wants to believe that he's right and the other kid is wrong. What is going to get the child to really work on himself, to grow, to excel? What? It's a natural desire? No. There's something he's going to get at the end of the day. Now, whether it's a material thing or whether it's a non-material thing, I don't know. But there's got to be rewards. The Rambam said, of course it has to be a material thing. And this remains with people throughout their life. At what point does a person reach the stage, if this is so fantastic, what about when they become adults? Adults need rewards even more than children. What keeps them going? Who is going to go to work if he's not getting paid? And then why people need bonuses and raises and so on and so forth. Now, do they do the minimum just to get that? Yeah. Great. I'll agree with the concept that you do the minimum just to get that. But then a smart boss structures it. Structures it that you can only get... The system of rewards, I don't know of anything else that could replace it. And all of the questions and all of the so-called experiments reflect an inappropriate use of rewards. And that's what amazes me, that a person can come to that kind of conclusion. There are, you'll see in the business world, in baseball, sometimes, for whatever reason, they'll give a person too much. All of the criticisms, again, that he has of the reward system, the way I saw it and what he's writing, is a misuse of it. It's a misuse of it because it's not geared in any way to stimulate the student or whoever it is to do anything more than the minimal. Obviously, you have to use intelligence with that. If the prize is something which demands creativity, for example, even on these stupid reality shows, you know, you have these couples or whatever competing, so they're all for the prize. Now, if they have to solve problems, if that's part of the test, the endurance, they're placed in certain situations and so on and so forth, and then they have to stop and think and use their minds. So it's true that they're only doing it in order to get the objective, but nevertheless, in the course of doing it, they're learning a great deal. They're gaining a lot of experience. So I can't understand that objection. There's a lot of misuse. If you, for example, athletes that they pay a tremendous amount to, because they expect that he's going to perform tremendously, it could be taking away the incentive. It doesn't work in the situation where he has no further incentive because he's got a 10-year contract, you know, for a few hundred million dollars. So that's not, in my opinion, that's not smart because you took away the incentive. He's already got all the money. And that's the cases where you'll see. Or it could be other psychological factors. Sometimes it's too much of a pressure. It's too much of a pressure because he feels he can't live up to that. So you have to know the psychology of these things. And that's another. How can he have these experiments and these tests? You have to factor in psychology and so on and so forth. So that's why he takes these simplistic tests and half the kids did this, half the kids did that. They're not convincing. They're not valid. They're not legitimate tests because they weren't structured properly. In terms of learning... The rewards is not what turns people on to learning or off to learning. All people who like to learn and developed in learning did so because at some point there was an incentive. Whether it had to be some kind of reward, even if it's just superego, that the Rebbe, you know, they feel that God approves of them, the mitzvah, whatever it was only rewards. The rewards themselves won't turn you on or turn you off. It's got to be at a certain point that the person enjoyed the experience of learning. That's got to happen. So ultimately, it's not going to be an issue of rewards or not rewards. It's going to be your encounter with learning. If you reach that point, you've got to cultivate a desire for learning and an enjoyment of learning. So then... you know, you're on the right track. Do you need, if you reach the point where you don't need any other reward, where the learning itself becomes the reward, that's the highest level. Very few people reach that level. So that, don't you think that the majority of people today that are learning, and Daf Yomis and so on and so forth, aren't they learning for a reward? They're learning for a reward. They expect to get it in heaven. They're going to be go to Olam Haba, or to whatever extent God will protect them and their families, their children, because they're doing the mitzvot. The whole Judaism works on rewards. Take away reward. Why did God have reward and punishment? He's this anti-Torah, his position. So what do you need reward and punishment? That's a fundamental of fundamentals.
So what learning for those reasons?
Of course, ultimately, we want people to reach a level where the learning is the end in itself. But we also recognize that human nature is such that it's a very, very difficult thing. Not all are zochet to that. And all require rewards at some point. And even when you get you reach the point where you enjoy the learning, it still doesn't mean there's other emotions, there's laziness, there's other things you want to do, so on. Because the learning, it takes a long time till a person reaches the level where he wakes up in the morning and he just wants to learn. It's a hard thing. So even people that enjoy learning tend to procrastinate, or they may have batala, things of that sort. So to just remove all kinds of rewards, I'm not sure. But whatever the case may be, the vast majority of mankind, who doesn't need rewards? That's why I found the whole notion like absolutely preposterous. Where's this coming from? So simplistic. If you want to write a critique of the educational system and you want to overdo the system, do it over, it's valid. I agree with all the, not his criticism, all the critiques that children are not taught properly what the subject matter, what the goals are, how to think properly, and so on and so forth. The system itself, the testing, all this, that's a reward system, but it's not a good reward system. So all that stuff has to be changed and restructured. But even after you've done all that, maybe you'll reduce the amount of reward, of extraneous reward. Because the more enjoyment in the activity, the more the child is inclined to want to do it. But you're not going to be able to remove, if you take away reward, you're taking away incentive, and talented children will have no incentive. And they'll never develop their abilities. They'll never grow, they'll never develop. To grow, to develop means, what is it? Isn't growing and developing means going beyond where you're at right now? Go to the next level. Well, why should I? I'm comfortable right now. Oh, because there's a reward up there. The whole world works on that basis. Otherwise, you'd be complacent. So that's it. I'll stick where I am. Why should I change? To the contrary, when you've reached a certain level of comfort at skating or any sport, when the person says, yeah, well, let's go to the next level. So in the short term, the person is not enjoying it as much. He's going to lose what he enjoys, and he's going to be doing tedious things because, you see, that's the point. You want the child to be engaged in those kinds of activities which we would call deferred gratification. Whenever you're involved in deferred gratification, you're taking away incentive right now. Right now, I'm not enjoying it. So you tell the person, yeah, but you'll enjoy it later. So right off the bat, you're in that arena where you need to motivate the person to want to continue striving for a goal that he himself does not see or envision, but you do. That's a leader. So you've got to create the proper incentives. If you set up a task and you give out the reward, and the reward will be given even if you do the most minimal, so of course that's what people are going to do. And it goes without saying. I'm not arguing on that. But I'm just saying that why would you set it up that way? You don't give the reward, or you give less of the reward. The reward is structured to reward the kind of behavior that you want. That's baby stuff. Everybody knows that. So, you know, if it doesn't make any difference, if I have a task to take something and deliver it somewhere, and I will get paid for just delivering it. I don't have to see that it got to this person's hand. I don't have to see anything like that. All I have to do is open the door and put it inside, and I will get my reward. So of course I'm going to do that. Why would I want to do more? If the objective is to get me to do more, then the reward will have to incorporate that objective. And again, you'll have the same principle. That people will do the same way. People will do the minimal until they reach a level where they recognize something else, and they don't want to do the minimal for some reason because they see something else. Of course, that's the goal. even grades, which we're not talking about grades, and students are only concerned with the grade. The reason why students are only concerned with the grade is not. It's not because that there are grades, the whole system of grades. It's because the teachers don't interest them at all. They take these meaningless classes, and the teachers do not give them a reason to get interested in the subject matter. If the grade serves the purpose of keeping the kid in line, because you've given him an incentive to take the course. In order to get the grade, you have to make the child, you know, that's the reward. The reward is the grade. You have to set it up that you can't get that unless you obtain, you get the learning that, or the objective, whatever it is of that class. Now, the reason why the kid doesn't go beyond that is because the class, he's not given by the teacher any incentive. Now the teaching should attach him. It should attach him to the subject matter itself. So now you take out a book, well, an interesting book, and what's the plot? What's the thing? Then the kid is curious. He'll get involved in it. The fact that he's getting a grade is going to prevent him from getting serious about the book. Doesn't make sense. Anybody can go back. When I went to school, when you went to school, we were all concerned about the grades, this and that, but some classes you enjoyed. You really enjoyed them. The fact that you were getting a grade stopped you? If anything, no. No, now you're happy because not only will I enjoy it, but now I can get an A. It's a double reward. So I just don't see it. The whole society would stop working if we remove rewards. Tips. Why do people give tips? Because you get better service that way. Why? Because the guy is happier. He doesn't enjoy serving your meal. How many people want to be waiters? But if you're nice to him and you give him a tip, so it becomes a pleasant experience. You'll get good service. He's not going to do, well, the minimal? I don't know. I don't know, because that's also a factor that increases the tip also. That he doesn't just do the minimal, but he serves with a smile and he's friendly. You see that with waiters. The good waiters who get the best tips don't do the minimal. Now, that's a perfect support for what I'm saying. They don't just take the food and put it on your table, the minimal. They want to get the tip, and they know that the customer is going to take into consideration all the factors. It was prompt. He spoke nicely. He was friendly. It was a pleasure to have this waiter. So therefore, the waiter can't do the minimal because the very reward is dependent upon doing the maximal. That's a perfect illustration of what I'm saying. If the goal is that he should enjoy being a waiter, the next question is, can the activity lend itself to that? If it can lend itself to that, then you use the rewards to get him into that mode, and then when he's in that mode, he really experiences all the... Let's assume, for argument's sake, that serving people who are cheerful and like it, and let's assume that's something enjoyable. So he will come to the point where he'll enjoy it. Will the enjoyment be so great that he won't want a reward anymore? Probably not, because he needs to make a living and so forth. But that's the nature of the activity. The nature of the activity is not one which can produce those kinds of results. If you take away the reward, you have no chance, can't move. You'll have someone who will have no incentive to progress, and he'll stagnate. So you need the reward. But the reward, again and again, has to be in conjunction with the ability to make the activity one which the person will really want to do. That's something else. That, of course, must be there. The reward can't create that. But the reward won't hurt that. To the contrary, the reward will help that goal. The proper use of the reward is a great tool that should be used. See, Chazal say that when kids are very little, you should give them treats on Shabbos. Treats, candies, this and that. Because it makes an impression on their unconscious. There's an association. It makes it pleasant. When they grow up, they'll have a certain pleasantness about Shabbos. They may not know. It's May 12th, Masoret. Just a little bit continuation of the discussion of rewards. It seems that everything that was said in the name of that author that is against the idea of rewards, and that rewards causes the person to have a different attitude towards studying or whatever the case may be, I say just the opposite. The absence of rewards causes a person to denigrate what he's doing. People always need to have incentives. People at jobs, if they've haven't gotten a raise or whatever, So they feel a lack of enthusiasm for what they're doing. You see, even in Mitzrayim, that the Jews had labored and so forth, and God saw to it that they were compensated. Yeah, that they went to the Egyptians, and the Egyptians, and they had to ask the Egyptians to borrow things, etc. Which I would say that the fact that the presence or the absence of rewards does have an effect upon the person's attitude, but in the exact opposite way. That is, if you're doing something and nobody seems to care about it, or you're not getting paid for it, or you're not getting a goodly pay for it, so then the person might denigrate the value of it. But within reason, if it's recognized as being important, and the person who does it is recognized as being important because there's compensation for it, so that would seem to increase the importance of it, and then the person has a better attitude towards it. People who don't get rewarded feel that they're not appreciated. If there's a bonus, that's why the whole world of business operates on these things. There's a bonus, and so on and so forth. It's basically, in my view, impossible to operate, to motivate in these types of things. Most of the kinds of things that we want our students to achieve and so forth is not in line with their nature as they are now. So you're asking them to change their nature. You're asking them to cultivate a capacity or a desire to do things that don't come easily, and they're not fun. So you're dealing with the issue of deferred gratification, if ever, if they ever get to the point where they really enjoy the activity. Hence, you need to overcome the resistance. And of course, see, a good teacher, I've always stated this, a good teacher has the ability to make it enjoyable. So the more the child gets into it, and the more the child finds it enjoyable, the easier it gets, because the motivation now lies within the activity itself. But again, in order to, at the outset for sure, at the outset you have to have something which is compelling right now. And even after the child is accustomed to it and so forth, he may not be that into it. You still may need other incentives. And as I said, we're constantly demanding that the child go to the next level, the next level. So it's not like just turning on a switch. Once you've turned them on, that's it. You've got to prompt them to go to the next level. And that's just in terms of learning. There's so many other things where good behaviors, all of the ethical ideals that we believe in, essentially are contrary to your emotions. As we said, the essence of the perfection in the mitzvos, ben adam l'chavero, are in those mitzvos that go contrary to your emotions. You see the lost object of your enemy and so forth. So you're really going contrary to the emotions, and thus there's got to be incentives and there's got to be consequences. Those two things. It's very important to emphasize that the reward has to be structured in a way that it prompts the person to give his all. Let's say the reward would be tickets to the World Series, you know, something like that, to a group of kids. Now, obviously, it's got to be something that they really want very badly. But the reward would be if you write the best essay on a certain topic. So you know that what are they going to do? They're going to stay up by day and by night. They can't do this in a minimalistic way. The nature of what's asked of them is something which doesn't lend itself to minimalism, because it's got to be high quality. It's going to be graded by judges, so on and so forth, whatever. So now they're going to research that topic. They're going to try to get the edge, you know, and they can't do it in a minimalistic way. That's how it works, sports, teams, competition, you know, debating competitions, teams, there's a prize at the end. It doesn't let, so you have to work by day and by night.
All right, I can respond to that.
Creative people, people that are very creative and, you know, don't do the minimum and so on and so forth. But I said, if you were to stop paying them, what would they do? They're not just going to go ahead, you know, with doing all these kinds of things. They need some context in which they're going to be rewarded for their creativity. Another problem with this is that you can't write a book about the utilization of rewards, whether you should use them or not, if you don't outline what the goal is. How do you write a book without, well, what's my goal? What is his goal? So the first area apparently is is jobs. Now you're telling me that the reward system in jobs is not effective? Yeah. What do you expect people? To the contrary, well, again, I'll say it depends on how it's done. The reward system, if it's not utilized correctly, can be counterproductive. Sometimes you give a person too little money. Sometimes you give the person too much money. Or what point in time? What does the person have to do? There's many factors that influence it. So you have to know. And again, it's not that, I will say that there's all different kinds of rewards. There's the pay that he gets, there's the bonus, but there's another kind of an intangible reward. That is, I mean, I could show you that perhaps, let's assume I could show you that those bosses, supervisors, whatever it is, that know how to relate. There is leadership involved too. Those who know how to relate to people in a certain way will get a lot out of them. That too is a reward of a different kind. That is, they want to please. They want the approval. So to merely rely on the materialistic, that's one thing. In certain situations, it'll be all you need. But intelligent people realize that how you treat people is important. I mean, that's also a reward. Now, this book puts praises, the psychological, in the category of rewards, and he's opposed to that too. Which, again, I mean, if I thought he didn't know what he's talking about until now, that's sheer insanity. You can't raise a kid without praises and approval and so on and so forth. So, what are you going to substitute in the world of business? What are you going to substitute? What is going to motivate people to work hard, put in all those hours, and so on and so forth? History, the whole history shows that that's the problem in a socialist-like economy, where people don't have to work. That it doesn't matter. There's the redistribution. You take away the incentive factor, and you can have stagnation. According to his proposition, yeah, you should cut back the salaries and people will perform better. I mean, they won't perform at all, they'll quit. It's not only the money, obviously. You can also keep them. Just because they're getting the money doesn't mean that they're going to be necessarily happy. That's something else. The happiness on the job is not just the money, because the happiness has to do with other factors. Enjoying the work, the people, you know, the friendship. There's a lot of other factors. But that's the question, do you enjoy what you do? That's a different point. We're talking about the issue of rewards in terms of motivating people to do the best possible job. That's what I'm suggesting. There's no way he's going to come up with anything other than that. Money is the main. You must have rewards. Without rewards, you're not going to get people to give it their best. In the world of business, since people have to make a living, and also people want, the reward is the thing they want the most. The thing that people want the most, even yeah, theoretically they want the most, is this feeling of satisfaction. But practically what they want the most is money. Because that's what they need. They got to pay for their life. They got to pay tuitions, blah, blah, blah. They need the money. So they can't afford to just do what they like to do. Great, if I can also do what I like to do and make money, that's the lottery. But first and foremost, I've got to pay my bills. So that's what's going to get them. They got to pay their bills. If they didn't have to pay their bills, and suddenly they got wealthy, they're not going to work. Every guy that wins the lottery, at least at first, is going to retire. Which indicates that they don't enjoy, that no one's going, the fact that that is true, that everybody who wins the lottery is going to quit his job, that shows that they were doing it just for the money. No matter what they say, even people that enjoyed what they were doing, even people that enjoy they're enjoying their teachers, they enjoy it, they like to teach children, blah, blah, blah. Then they win the lottery, 99.9% will retire. And we'll show you that the enjoyment they got from the job was not sufficient to do it. It's a very noble thought to talk about restructuring the job, etc., etc., so it's really fun and people want to get up and go and do it. It's easy to say that. It's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult to actualize that because here's the problem. The problem is that the way any enterprise works, you want to be a doctor, you want to be a lawyer and so on, you're creating a certain system. You have to learn how to do the job. If you're an accountant, you have to learn how to do the taxes, make out the forms, do the audit. Now, on the one hand, what you're trying to do is to master it, so it's sort of to make it more and more automatic, so to speak. And less, or challenging, whatever the case may be. Routine. In order for a business to work, you need routine, routine, routine. Now, the routinization is very efficient in terms of the objective phenomenon, but to the extent that it becomes more routine, to that extent it becomes less interesting because it's repetitive. What they want to do is to repeat, like, the assembly line to make cars. That was the big breakthrough of Henry Ford, so that everything becomes like a machine. And you repeat the same step over and over and over again. And then the machine can do it. You want to make it that way. The more it becomes routine, which is good for efficiency, the less it becomes meaningful to the individual who's doing it. And that's true even a lawyer. Lawyers, he's got to go to school for a number of years. He's got to read. And there may be a point when he's learning new things. He may find that it's challenging and all of that. But eventually, you're going to get into a job, and you're going to have to. You can't just every day I'll take out something which is challenging, and I'll take on that case and then another. It doesn't work that way because you got to pick a specialty, and you got to immigration law, this, that, and it's all the same. And you pretty much. That's the way you got to function. It gets broken down into various parts, and you become the expert in this field. So this is your field. The more of an expert you are, the more you're eliminating. You want to eliminate uncertainties and doubts. You want to make it simple. That's an irony here. The objective is to make it as simple as possible, which, if it's successful, will lead to making it as unchallenging as possible. Yeah. You don't want to go in every day and have a tremendous challenge. Occasionally that happens, and then you find it interesting. So you're caught up in that. You're doing the same thing pretty much over and over and over again. Basketball stars are doing it only for the money. When a basketball star or a football, base, whatever it is, when they retire, they never play. They'll never just on a Sunday afternoon, let's go and play ball. It has become so boring and routine because it's like, it's coming out of your throat already. That's all this guy's done his whole life, and he's only done it to make money. And now it's over. So he'll hardly ever look at it again. Now the same is true. The reality of work, that's the nature of malacha. The reality, there are some people who are fortunate, are in a situation where they can continuously find things that they enjoy. But those are the exceptions. There may be certain types of professions which do lend themselves to more creativity. They're okay, but by and large, the overwhelming majority, you're a nurse, whatever it is, you're doing the same kinds of things. which at first you may have enjoyed them. A lot has to do with learning and being mastering it, and wow. But after a while, it becomes very, very repetitive, and it doesn't have the capacity to give you that kind of enjoyment. It's in the nature of the situation. It's not by accident. I mean, people look forward to the weekend, everybody. It's not because they're getting paid. To the contrary, if they weren't getting paid, there would be no workforce altogether. It's a nice thought. I don't think it works. If you're on the Supreme Court, where you're sitting at the top, and you don't have to do all the tedious work, and all the cases that come before you are major issues as society develops, the rights of the individual, is there such a thing as a right to abortion, and you have all these interesting things, so then I could see it. I don't know. I've never read about the lives of the justices on the Supreme Court. But I could... That you can see, it's not tedious, it's not the same thing, it's always something new, and it's also exciting because the whole society depends upon how you view this, and so on and so forth. So you will find, obviously, you're going to find certain areas which do lend themselves to being ongoing in an ongoing way. It's interesting. It's always a challenge, it's always something, and it's different. But that is not... The rule, that's rather the exception, that most of the labor that's done, whether you physical labor, production, look at the agriculture, you know, it's mastering a tractor, it's mastering a certain set, you got to master. Once you master a system, then what's needed is that you're very good at seeing that it gets repeated, and you don't want to deviate from that. So therefore, you're going to face the problem of boredom. Boredom is the biggest issue. It's true of virtually anything. You know, people have this fantasy and they go on these vacations. After a while, you get bored. Because it's all in the imagination, and then you face reality, and there's nothing in the reality to make it interesting in an ongoing way. If you love the outdoors and you like exploring and you become a guide, a tour guide, so you take people on these things, and you're doing something which you're making money, but you love it and you enjoy it, that's great. But that's the exception. There too, since the psyche of a person is geared towards reward, he wants reward, I venture that many of these people who are doing these things that they say they love and they enjoy, let's just see what happens when there's no salary. Will they keep going back to work? I doubt it. The for most people, the need to get paid and the disinclination to do a job for no reward is very powerful, and it's very rare that a person is going to go to a job every day and work if he's not getting paid, even if he likes the job. Take a rare individual that will continue to do it and he's not getting paid, because there are other emotions that will overpower him. In a situation like Russia, where there was low salary, there was no rewards, there was nothing to look forward to, there was no incentive, you're going to get stagnation. That is, people will do the minimum. In a situation like that, people will do the minimum because there's no reason to do more than the minimum. And you'll probably have also, there was a lot of drinking and smoking.
Yeah, no, I agree with it.
Drinking, smoking, which you have that in Western society too. It's not really. I mean, that's a different issue. In Russia, it's because of misery. But you know, that's not a good barometer, because the other side, our hedonistic society, also leads to the same end with drugs, and maybe for a different reason. Because they're lacking the true values, and they know. Neither society has the ability to achieve happiness. If you're gonna get into the issue of the achievement of happiness, which society is closer, or where there's more unhappiness? Again, these things are hard to measure. But it's a different discussion. The freedom of America and all the wealth and the hedonistic has not produced a high level of happiness. So I mean, that's not what I'm talking about. But you see from there, I think it's a perfect example that where there's no incentives, there's no rewards, it doesn't make any difference. It does not make any difference how you do your job. So by and large, people are just going to do their job. And they're going to do the minimal. Because that's the job. In order to get my check, what's the minimal I have to do? Now, I mean, that's how, if I was in that situation, that's rational, by the way. That's a rational thing. Why should I do more? If I'm working for the government, whatever it is, a regular postal worker, whatever the case may be. So what is the makeup? What's going on over here? The guy is working for the post office, delivering the mail, which is absolutely, completely unrewarding in and of itself. I don't know how you could take a job like that and make it into something enjoyable. Yeah, the only enjoyment is the day is, oh, I finished. I delivered all the mail I was supposed to deliver. It's like, you know, lugging the groceries inside. How are you going to take that and make it fun?
I think if a person listens to a tape
of things. Well, when a person, I'm not saying a postal, I used to tell you, a postal worker, a mailman, so to speak, in the United States could be a terrific job. It could be a terrific job because for the right kind of person. Because it's not that demanding. I understand the hours are pretty good, and if you don't have to stay a certain amount of hours. It's just you're given a certain amount of mail to deliver, and once you've delivered it, you're free. So if you're quick, you know, you're outdoors. It's to the contrary. You can enjoy the fact that there's no stress. There's no stress connected because you don't have to be creative. And you get to walk around. Oh, excuse me. The reason why it could be a good job if you have the right mentality is, A, you don't have to have all the stresses. You're outdoors. There's exercise. Now, if you're into learning, you have plenty of time in which you can learn. Yeah, as I said, you can... Actually, when you're doing the job, you know, you have to focus, you know, deliver the mail, so on and so forth. But let's say, you know, as I said, you can finish early, so the day is not that long. You have free time. You can learn in your free time when you're off, when the job is over, because you don't have to, there's no stresses associated with it. And even during the job itself, while you're walking, or as I said, if you finish early and you have to wait around, you could have a safer. A person that's so inclined... The truth of the matter is, it doesn't even have to be someone who's in learning. It could be anyone that has this type of an attitude. So he likes to read books, or he likes to listen to music, and so on. He too. But the problem, however, is that for the average person, I don't know if... You gotta have a certain kind of a makeup. You have to have a certain kind of makeup that you're content with a simpler life. Because it's not looked up to in society, again, because he's not making a lot of money and so on and so forth. So a person like that would have to contend with living a more moderate life and not getting the prestige of being a big earner. That's another superego. It's in our society, it's psychologically very difficult for many people to do that. If a person could do that and adjust to a more moderate life, then the issue would be the boredom factor. Well, he's bored stiff. That's a huge problem. Now, if a person had an alternative activity which gave him satisfaction, so then he could remove the boredom problem. I say, for someone who's in learning, doesn't have these kinds of problems because he only views the purpose of work in the first place as just a means to an end. And he's not concerned, I mean, theoretically, he's not concerned about... the prestige, because his only interest is to be able to learn. If a person has that kind of mentality, so those kinds of jobs could be good. But what I'm saying is like this. This person who wrote this book about rewards, there's no way he's going to take that job and make it fun. I just don't... There's no way. It's ridiculous. You know, there are people that collect the garbage. That's it. It's a job. There's no way that it's fun. If, in fact... It's bad. The way they do it over here, it's very cool. They have the garbage collector, or and now you have to refer to it as the sanitation engineer, does not even get out of the truck. Like in New York, you have to get out and pick up the garbage and toss the stuff in. So it's, I guess, maybe more demeaning. Here, they have this thing with hooks. And yeah, the city issues everybody. You don't buy your own garbage cans. They issue the standard kind of thing, and the truck comes by, and it's automated. Picks it up, and it, you know, it turns it upside down, and it empties everything into the truck. And then he puts it down. Again, it's all done from the wheel of the car. He doesn't even have to get out. Now, which one is better off? I don't know. The other one has more actions to do. At least he gets out. But this guy is complete boredom. He just, there's no way to change that kind of a thing. It's a boring job. So why would a person do it? Well, because there's incentives. There's rewards. This is the kind of job that can be done by a robot. If the job is subject to robotic accomplishment of it, so then you know it's lacking in interest, because that's the definition. Something can be done by a robot when every task has been mastered and there's no surprises. It doesn't require any kind of creative thinking, because a robot will not think creatively. You store a lot of data, so you know you can punch in, you could program a lot of possible scenarios that it'll have the data to react to, but nothing will be creative. It can't come up with a new idea. So that's basically the way it is. In Russia, that group of scientists or the others, teachers, whatever it was, that group that put more energy into their job, I would say it's because the job itself lent itself to that. That was one thing. In order for a job to be interesting, it has to lend itself to the possibility of being interesting. So science and discovery and so on, only those areas where they were called upon to really think and so on and so forth, where there was room to use creativity. And since there was nothing else in the society that gave pleasure, pretty much, so that was the motivation. There was that too can produce. For example, another way to push people to produce would be to remove. Yeah, you can go to the other extreme and remove all the external rewards. Yeah, put a person on a deserted island. Pretty much with the primitive facilities and so forth. So there's no television, there's no movies, radio, all the distractions, and there's a library with certain kinds of books. So yeah, the person's going to put all of his energy into that eventually, because he'll go crazy. So that's another way in which you can motivate people. You can set up a situation of extreme deprivation where there's only one possible outlet. I'll show you an interesting story. I suggested this movie. How many people saw the movie that I recommended? Now, which one is that? Which is the one I'm going to mention right now in this context? Birdman of Alcatraz. It's a great movie. Burt Lancaster, great movie. It's based on a true story. The basic idea is this person who was a violent individual. He was sentenced to life imprisonment for murder. And I think physical isolation when you're, solitary confinement. So he was basically removed from any source of any kind of possible psychological enjoyment. And one day a bird flew over and was injured, whatever it is. He went on, that's the story of how he went on to, he had to absorb himself. He studied the entire field of treating of animals, veterinarianism, he read everything, and he became very creative in terms of cures and so on and so forth. He became a tremendous genius in the field. So it shows you how the person was completely transformed as a result of the fact that he was a different person. So I suggest you see that movie. It's enjoyable. So true, there's different ways in which people can be motivated. You can put a person in a situation of extreme deprivation, and that will be you'll motivate the person. So perhaps in Russia, because life was so bleak, and they did not have the materialistic rewards and pleasures to look forward to that we have here. Each, there's no side, it's perfect. I'm not saying that our system is perfect. It's got its advantages, it's got its disadvantages. The other, that society, because it didn't have any of those things, this was one of the few areas where a person could feel good about life. That is, he had a skill, and it meant a lot. You have to realize also, another important element in providing the sense of satisfaction is not just the nature of the activity. This is an important point. The nature of the activity and the context. That the activity should be something which is important. A person has to feel that what he's doing is meaningful and important to satisfy his superego, his sense of meaning. A person has a certain innate, ingrained sense of importance, meaning. And that's why people, I always say that, you know, even in sports, which is just a game, they build it up and the Hall of Fame, and they try to attach a certain type of importance to it, which is really ridiculous, but that's necessary, because people have to believe that this is, how can you put so much energy and spend so much money on something which has no meaning whatsoever? Who cares? Which team got the ball through the hoop? I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. Not that there's anything wrong for fun, but to put all of that money and everything into it is ridiculous. So they have to try to pretend that it really matters, that it's really important. So these people in Russia, that's the deprivation syndrome. Since life was bleak and there was nothing to look forward to, so they had to find something. They were qualified because the activity of science, that's thought, that's discovering, and education is teaching. So teaching someone is a meaningful phenomenon. It's too intellectual and it's meaningful. Because of course, in Russia they recognize the importance of science, scientific discovery. So a person feels he accomplished something. And teachers, there's a lot of reward. There is a lot of reward for a teacher. Even a teacher is not getting a lot of pay, is getting a different kind of reward. The students look up to them. They're influencing students. The students look up to them. They're very important. And that's one area where potentially, see, also in Russia, it's easier to be a teacher in Russia. A teacher in America, the public school system has become almost impossible to, in a lot of these places, to control the kids, because the society itself has removed a lot of the power of the principal, the teacher, etc., and the students can, you know, they can get away with a tremendous amount. So it's a struggle for a teacher. But in Russia, it's different. Education is looked up to, and educators are looked up to. Educators are looked up to because it's very, very important. And the student has to behave and show tremendous respect for the teacher, so the teacher doesn't have to fight with the student. Thus, by the way, these are all good things. I think America has suffered a great deal from the breakdown of the disciplinary system in the schools and the weakening of the teacher, his ability to control the class, etc. But have a situation like that in Russia where you have the students have to behave and show tremendous respect for the teacher. The teacher now there's a certain importance. The very respect, the importance, and the work itself to teach. You're involved in ideas, and you can feel good about yourself, and you get the respect, and you get all of that. So that, in my opinion, would explain why the teachers would excel. But that's the motivation. The motivation there is not coming from the paycheck. But it is coming from the paycheck. It is coming from the paycheck too, because everybody needs a paycheck. Everybody needs a paycheck. You know, you take away the paycheck, you're not going to teach over there either. Except the motivation to go beyond the minimum and do more is because there's nothing else. Since you're not getting a paycheck, then there's nothing to spend it on except for your basic necessities. There's no arena in which I can feel good about myself. There's no arena of happiness. So, you know, I excel in that. And that gives me a certain satisfaction. And that makes life worth living. And then you don't have to come home and drink a few bottles of vodka. You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk about the questions that arise about nursing homes, giving care to elderly people. That's a perfect example of where people, I would say there's a lot of abuse. It's not the kind of job that's enjoyable on any level. Except for, again, there might be an isolated individual who has psychological reasons why they want to do this. But the average person, it's boring, it's repetitive, and there's not always, you know, you're dealing with elderly people, so it doesn't provide the same happiness that you're really helping someone. These people are pretty much at the end of the road, and I don't think that there's any personal satisfaction. And that's why there's a lot of abuse in these places, because people can get away with a lot. So unless, that's why it's very important that if you have relatives, there are some people from, right now there's one person from the shul who's in a nursing home temporarily because he's 89, but he broke his hip over Pesach, and I visit him, I try to visit him at least once a week, but my being there is important. The mitzvah of Bikur Cholam, I thought of another, the mitzvah of visiting the sick is important. In these kinds of situations or in a hospital, because you have to make sure that they're getting, is he getting the right treatment? There's a lot of neglect. They could be giving him the wrong medicine or they don't care, whatever. The fact that someone's coming to visit him makes them more alert. They're not going to take as much advantage because somebody's looking out. People that are there and have no one to visit or really check up on their situation, there's a greater possibility of neglect. So this is, I can understand there's nothing really enjoyable about doing these kinds of things. To the contrary, they're tough jobs to do because, you know, soiled linens and stuff, whatever. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that anybody would want to do. It's not pleasant. So why are people doing it? And the answer is it's a job and you get paid for it. Now, if the system was structured in a way that you could, you know, the reward, the getting, would be connected to doing the job in a really good way, that's what we're getting, you know, those are the rules. There's got to be oversight to make sure that people are doing it in the best possible way. But I don't think there's too much happiness and fun and enjoyment that you can extract from the activity of the job itself. In that kind of situation, if the pay is not good and so on, then it's really a big problem because the person is grumpy. If the worker is grumpy, they're going to take it out on the way they do the job, on the patients and so on and so forth. The reason why there's so much in this society about the TV and entertainment, everything revolves around entertainment. Basically, a person's time is divided between work, what we call work. You know, the things that a person has to do for survival. But that doesn't really satisfy the person. He needs. The need for a certain kind of gratification is very, very strong. So then, okay, I put in my day, now I'm entitled to fun. So after work, he goes to the bar, he watches the sport. He's trying to, like, extract as much as he can. Today, the way there's a lot of pressure today, and there's also a lot of this stuff with all the technology. You know, you could see all these events and so on and so forth, movies, games. So there's that's where the person directs him. That's the compensation, so to speak. To get compensation from all of these activities. That's an important point in terms of education and raising children, that obviously we raise them to recognize that work is a means to an end and the ultimate good is to be involved in Torah and perfecting the soul. But it's also important along the way to gear someone to be able to choose. It's a very, very difficult thing. Today, a lot of kids go to college, they have no idea what they want to do. And a lot of times they'll just choose something by default and they won't find it enjoyable. Part of the training for adulthood is to try and help the person to find out what he'd be good at and what he would enjoy. That's an interesting way of looking at this. The challenge is to really be able to cultivate that, a certain sense. I know they have guidance counseling and all of that, evaluating a person what field would be good for him. But it's also important to have the right attitude towards these things and to be able to set it up so that you're not miserable at work. A person that loves his job, that's like one of the biggest brachas, one of the biggest blessings. Because you're merging two things. He has to go to work every day and he enjoys it. And that's what people say. I can't believe I get paid to do this. When you hear a person say that, there's no simple solution. I mean, I'm not saying he's an absolutely happy person, but that goes a long way. The person who's miserable at work doesn't mean he's going to have a miserable life because there's compensations. He may have a great family life, he may have friends, but then this person is already working, looking to compensate for a very bad experience. The person who loves his work is starting off ahead of the game. Doesn't mean he's going to be absolutely happy either, because he could have a miserable home life, you know, things of that sort. But it's an important element. It's an extremely important element in the happy life to really, as much as possible, be doing something you like to do and gives you a lot of satisfaction. Puts you in a great position for life. May 13th, Masoret. The Rambam on the issue of Torah Lishma, because we've been discussing the educational approach of eliminating all kinds of rewards from the educational system, which I've been contending. My position has been that up to a point, rewards are absolutely necessary. However, the effectiveness of rewards and how it affects the attitude of the student towards learning and so on and so forth, that depends upon a number of factors. First of all, how the rewards are used. See, there are two variables over here that must be considered. How the rewards are used, but how the teaching is done as well. You can't eliminate that. So that if the teacher is not able to present the material in an engaging way and to make it interesting, and ultimately, if it's interesting, it'll become enjoyable, so then the whole thing isn't going to work. That is the intangible, but that's the most important thing in the entire educational system. And that is overlooked completely. Everybody's looking for a system. Whether the system is to give rewards or whether the system is to remove rewards. All these things are secondary, are accidental. Although, in my opinion, the motivational factor of a reward until the student is able to grasp the purpose and the benefit is pretty much essential. It's absolutely essential, I would say. But the most important thing, ultimately, is the teaching. And that is not even considered. I don't care what the system is. If the teacher doesn't make the material interesting, so it's going to fail. Anyways, the Rambam, here he's quoting from a tshuva of the Rambam. He says, I don't have the entire tshuva, he just selects a little piece about various statements in the Gemara about Torah Lishma and Torah Shelo Lishma, which that is inserted. He's saying that apparently they contradict each other, because sometimes they say that a person should only learn Lishma. Lishma means for the sake of the learning. And in another place it says that he should learn even not Lishma, not for its own sake. Now that's what we're talking about. We're talking about lo lishma, not for its own sake, because that's the whole idea of rewards. Rewards means that you're not doing the action for the sake of the action, but you're doing it for an extraneous reward. So he says it's not a contradiction, because we learn out from both. He says the position of the Torah is She'ein roi lasog el lishma, that it's only appropriate to learn Torah lishma. V'lishma hu ha'ikar, and lishma is the essential. V'lo nitztavinu el lasog bo lishma, and we have only been commanded to be osek in Torah lishma. So that's a very strong statement. He's saying the entire mitzvah, the entire essence of Talmud Torah is to learn Torah lishma. Then he goes and he makes a very, very strong statement. He says, "Va'osek shelo lishma," and one who is osek in Torah lo lishma, not for its own sake, roi lo shelo nivra. It would be appropriate that he had never been born. Would have been better if he'd never been born. So apparently that's a very terrible thing. Then he says, "Ve'afal pikein tovu lasok ba." Nevertheless, it is good for him to be osek in the Torah shelo lishma, even though he's already stated that it's better that he hadn't been born. Why? Me'es shelo asak ba kalika. It's better that he should engage in Torah, not lishma, as opposed to not engaging in it at all. Because this person who is osek, who is involved in Torah, even if it's not for the appropriate reason, ha'al v'asak ba, since he engaged in it, mito shelo lishma yevo lishma. Since he engaged in it from the lo lishma, which means to say that extraneous motivation, it will come to lishma. I think that is a statement of the Torah's educational philosophy. That is, the purpose of Torah, the purpose of learning, is an end in itself. It is not subservient to any other goal. It's not even subservient to the goal of knowing the halacha. That is, obviously you can't perform the mitzvah if you don't know it. Yeah, but a person can ask a question, he can learn it from somebody else. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to learn, because learning is an end in itself. And that's the whole mitzvah of Talmud Torah. That's the first premise. The second premise is that a person in his natural state of being is incapable of fulfilling that mitzvah. I mean, this is my spin on it. That is, once again, you have a dilemma. On the one hand, you're only supposed to learn lishma, for the sake of Torah, not for any other motivation. On the other hand, it is impossible for a person to achieve that due to his makeup. A person in his ordinary state, his natural makeup, is not in line with that goal. Tell this person that who wants to do something, obviously, he's got time on his hands and he's looking to do something and have fun. Tell him that he should sit and study, and that's really the best thing he could possibly be doing. Not because he's going to get anywheres in the world, but simply because that's the best thing he'd be doing. The person would think you're crazy. So, on the one hand, you're commanded lishma. On the other hand, it's an absolute impossibility. How can God give us a mitzvah which constitutes an absolute impossibility? A lot of the mitzvahs of the Torah, when you analyze them, they're rooted, at least the superficial understanding, in a major dilemma. You're supposed to pray to God, which means praise God, but on the other hand, you don't know God, you can't know God. God's unknowable, so it's something which you cannot do. Also, you have to find some kind of a compromise. That is, what is the meaning? What's the manner in which we can make sense out of this? So I think that the idea of that olam yasok adam shelo lishma, when we tell shelo lishma balishma, is a resolution of this. The resolution is that you create an incentive. You create an incentive. As long as you're cognizant that this is not the goal. The goal is lishma, but the methodology of reaching it is lo lishma, then you're permitted to do so. and he's Osek. You create an individual who is Osek, who's engaged. Then it says, now, of course, the next question is, well, how will he ever move on to the next phase? Now, that's the argument of those who are anti-rewards. Because the person is only doing it for a reward. And therefore, if you take away the reward, he won't do it. I mean, that's presupposing two things. It's presupposing that the person never changes. He's never affected by what he's doing. And it presupposes an activity. Not every activity is amenable. That's what I went through yesterday. That most of the occupations that people are engaged in are not amenable to a lishma orientation. Not amenable. Because they're limited and eventually they become repetitive and they become burdensome and boring. And there's no intrinsic desire to do these things except for some other purpose. Fulfill my responsibility, get paid, whatever it is. So Torah, however, is something which is amenable to Lishma due to the nature of Torah. And the idea is, see, it's not automatic. People can... This is a very complicated matter. I mean, there are people that have studied for years and they don't have the Lishma experience. I would have to make some reservations also that it's not all or nothing. That is, up until now I was low Lishma and today I'm Lishma. I would say that the goal of Lishma lends itself to quantification. That is, slowly but surely you become more Lishma oriented and less low Lishma. It doesn't mean that a person will reach an absolute Lishma level either. I think that it's not an easy thing, and there's different types of makeups. But it's not simple to say that if he's Osek, he will always come to Lishma. That's not my sense. My sense is that for many, many people, even though they've been learning for years and years, it doesn't reach the Lishma. Of course, you'd have to interview people to find out. That is, people that get up every day and they have a Daf Yomi program and covering ground and all of that, in my opinion, that's not what the Rambam means by Lishma. They have a motivation. They're doing it for the mitzvah, or to get credit, to cover ground, whatever it is, they need all these incentives. Why would a person need a Daf Yomi thing? Person that, is, of course, if he'll be able to say that he covered Shas. He's part of the group and he's going to do this and they're going to have the big meeting at the Madison Square Garden and the Seum. And he has a good feeling about himself. That he accomplished something worthwhile. He went through all of the Shas, all of the Gemara. But I don't see that as being Lishma. And I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying, the way I understand Lishma, it's, there is no motivation, it's purely for the enjoyment, for the good of being involved in Torah. If a person is doing it because of a superego reason, then he's forcing himself to do it. He's overcoming resistance and he's forcing himself to do it. So then, I don't know that that's Lishma. The person who does it Lishma is longing to do it because he recognizes that this is superior activity, infinitely superior to other activities. He wants to be engaged in this. It's like someone who engages in something because he enjoys it. A person who, lahavdil, of course, a person who plays golf on the weekends. He loves golf. He doesn't have to do it. So he looks forward. He doesn't need any incentive. That is the reward. The reward is that he can play golf. He's thankful that he can do this. So he's not doing it for anything else. A person that's doing it for something else because a lot of his clients play golf and It creates opportunities for business, but he himself doesn't like it. So then it's lo lishma. But I think that there aren't that many people that reach that level of lishma. Now, a lot has to do with one's experience in learning. A lot of people have not had good experiences in learning. People who've gone to the yeshivos and all, they haven't had good experience. And they don't really enjoy it or see, they don't see it the way it's projected. You know, the way the David HaMelech talks about it, opens one's eyes and lightning and the sweetness of Torah and all of those types of adjectives. They haven't seen that. That's something that's not addressed too much. Certain things nobody brings up. Sort of taken for granted. But I hear that. That's very important, that the Torah study should be conducted in a manner that a person really enjoys it and feels they're learning something and gaining in wisdom and understanding. Then, if a person gets into that, I think it sort of becomes addictive. I mean, that's in a good way. It has an addictive quality, and slowly but surely you find yourself missing it and wanting it. That type of thing. So I think that's what he means by Bitoch Shalol Lishma Bo Lishma. And that's with Torah, and that takes a long time. And even as a person is beginning to appreciate Torah, it doesn't mean that the attachment is so strong that it overpowers all the other emotions. He still may need support from the Lolishmas. But the role of the Lolishmas will diminish. Won't need that much Lolishma as he used to. So, given that that's the case, I can't see how one can make a case for the removal of rewards. And this is going to really be a good thing. What should be done is to strengthen, as best as in any area, to strengthen the attractability of the subject matter. The more the subject matter is attractive and fun and or the person begins to see the usefulness of it, the usefulness of the thing, the more he'll want to do it. And then, his attitude will change towards the subject matter. He'll want to do it, and then you won't need the reward. There's a famous story. I heard it from Rabbi Chait, that there was this individual in Lakewood. Rav Aaron Cutler, Zechman Levracha, was the great Gadol. He was the head of the yeshiva there. So there was an individual. He was an older person. And he would come to hear the shiur, but he wasn't religious. He was Jewish. And on Shabbos, I think he rented a hotel room, whatever. He would stay in his room and smoke a cigar, and then study the Gemara, because he enjoyed the mental challenge. And eventually people found out about it. According to the way I heard the story, I think Rav Aaron Cutler, when he found out about it, said that if he's not going to keep the mitzvos, then he shouldn't come to the shir. That's what I heard. But Rav Chait explained it. But what's wrong? He enjoys learning. At least he has that. That was the question. It became a hashkafa question in the yeshiva years ago. That was the question. If learning is the greatest good and the greatest pleasure, so okay, so he's not keeping Shabbos, but at least he's learning. What's wrong with that? So Rav Chait's answer was that the enjoyment that he has is the mental challenge. It's like playing chess, checkers. So that's what he found exciting. But he didn't believe that any of it was real. Because if he believed it was real, then he wouldn't, he would keep the Shabbos. So it's obvious that he did not regard the content as having truth. And the perception of the truth was not his aim. Not like, because if he saw it as truth, then he would keep it. So he just, whatever, however he understood it, this is a genius system, and it's challenging, and like many things, you know, games, whatever, crossword puzzles, whatever that people find challenging. Crack the system. But they don't believe that it's real, but it's mentally challenging. So that's not the Lishma of Torah. The Lishma of Torah is because of the enjoyment of the wisdom. In order to have that, a person has to see it as true. A person that's learning, say, Mishlei, because it helps them in life. But there's two ways you can look at that. If a person gets immersed in it, so then they're attached to it. But if a person, for example, a person just has an issue and they look up something in Mishlei and that's it, that's like, you know, you can open up a medical book because you want to know how to treat something, but that's it. Then you close the book. You're not involved in the love of the book itself. So if a person just uses Mishlei because it helps him on something, then he's not engaged in the study. If a person studies it and really enjoys studying it, so then it's Lishma. The fact that as a result, that doesn't detract from Lishma. Hold it a second. The fact that I'm learning truths about life and it makes my life better in every way, that doesn't detract from the Lishma of it. That's a part of the love of the Torah. That blends in. That qualifies the love of the Torah, that it's a book of truth, and that when a person understands it, it improves them in every way. It's not the same, though, as reading a manual, like an exercise manual, in order to learn how to do this move or that move. There, the activity of the study is not an end in itself. Here, the activity of the study is an end in itself, and additionally, it helps me in life. In order for the person to really enjoy the wisdom, he has to be convinced that it's wisdom, which means that it's true. But if it's not, if he doesn't think that it's true, but that it's, you know, it's smart. It's got a lot of, you know, it's mentally challenging. So then it's a mental exercise. That's not learning Lishma.
But how can person...
A person perceives the truth, first and foremost, is he's convinced that it's from Hashem. He's studying God's Torah, so that now he knows that it's true. And then he seeks to understand. And the more that he can understand, the greater it is. Some can understand more, some can understand less. But they're engaged in the activity because of the desire to understand God's wisdom. And that's why they want to do it. So, like the Gemara says, both the one who learns a lot and the one who learns a little, however, as long as he directs himself towards his Father in heaven, that's the purpose. He recognizes this is from God. And he wants to partake of the wisdom. So he's learning Lishma. That's what I'm saying. It's subject to degree and to development. The more the person puts in, the more sophisticated, the more the attachment and the enjoyment. Like the Gemara says, Ein simplicha taras hasveika. There's no joy like the resolution of a problem. The Gemara on Pei Zayin in Psachim, that's 87a. I'm just going to read from the English to make it easy. The word of the Lord that came unto Hoshea, the son of Be'eri, in the days of Uzziah, Yotam, Achaz, and Chizkiyahu, kings of Yehuda. Now the Gemara says, four prophets prophesied in one age, and the greatest of all of them was Hoshea. For it is said, the Lord spoke at first with Hoshea. Did he then speak first with Hoshea? Were there not many prophets from Moses until Hoshea? Said Rabbi Yochanan. So he says, He was the first of four prophets who prophesied in that age. And they are Hosea, Yeshayahu, Amos, and Micha. All right, so he's just, this is background, just establishing that Hosea was the greatest of them. Because Hashem spoke first with him. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Hosea, "Thy children have sinned," meaning Bnei Yisrael, Klal Yisrael have sinned. To which he should have replied, that's what the Gemara is saying, that he should have replied, "They are your children. They are the children of your favored ones. They are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Extend thy mercy to them." The Gemara is being very critical of Hosea. But he said to him, instead, Hosea said to him, "Sovereign of the universe, the whole world is thine. Exchange them for a different nation." See, the Gemara is deducing this. Because the whole story over here is that Hashem told him to marry a harlot and have children with her. So the Gemara is just putting what the reason is. Because the whole thing is an analogy for the fact that the Jew, that the harlot and the children represent the Klal Yisrael. They've been unfaithful. So that the Gemara is saying that Hosea regarded the Jews as being unfaithful and being unworthy, and therefore God should discard them, so to speak. So instead of answering him directly, God told him to go and marry a harlot and to have children with her. And then God, you'll see in the Haftarah, then God commands him to divorce her, send her away and send away the children. And then Hosea can't do it. It's the whole idea is to bring home to him, just like you're telling me to get rid of them, I'm going to put you in this situation, and then you'll understand. Which is, it's very difficult though, because it's two completely different situations. This is the story in the Gemara, which is sort of the preamble to reading the Haftarah, which is chapter 2 of the book of Hosea. Tosfos says, from the fact, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hosea. So Tosfos says, Mimasha Amar lo Lekach Eshet Zenunim, from the fact that God told him to take a prostitute, a woman of harlotry, Darish, he is making the drasha, Shemestama Kach Amar lo. Makes sense that this is, we can assume that this is what he said, the Kach Eshivo. It's interesting, Tosfos, because you see from this Tosfos that it's not that they had any tradition of passed down that this is what happened, but they used their wisdom to figure out things, and they came to this conclusion. Because why else would God tell him to do this and go through this experience to put him in a similar situation, quote unquote, in which, and then God would tell him to send her away. So they figured out that because Hosea couldn't understand why God doesn't dispose of them. That's what Tosfos is saying. This conversation is not recorded in Tanakh. The Gemara is establishing it. Because it says Lo Dayo. Of course, the story that you read the chapter, that's where it says that God told him to do this. But it doesn't tell you why. The Nevuah instructing Hosea to marry this woman and so on, and God tells him what to name the children, is in chapter 1. So really you have to do chapter 1 as well. After that whole experience, Hosea pours forth, so to speak, this prophecy about the nature of the Jews and so on and so forth, but it ends on a positive note. What the Gemara here is referring to is the prophecy in chapter 1, which is not the Haftarah, but it's essential to understanding the Haftarah. Now, when the Gemara says, is criticizing Hosea and saying, not enough that he didn't say this, he should have said, so it's imagining a conversation between Hosea and God, which is not recorded in the Tanakh, and they're criticizing him. Not only did he not say this, that they're your people, and so on and so forth, but he went ahead and he said this. That is, you're the sovereign of the universe, dispose of them. So that's pretty bold to recreate a conversation. On what basis did they do so? So Rashi says, the same thing as Tosfos. Atalomeid mimasha amal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kafcha esh hazanunim. You can learn this out from that which God said to him, to take the woman of harlotry. And God did not say this to any other prophet. After Hosea said this to God, sovereign of the universe, the whole world is thine, exchange them for a different nation, said the Holy One, blessed be He, what shall I do with this old man? Yeah, but the translation is zucking. I'm sorry, the Hebrew is the Gemara says, Moesel is zucking ze. What shall I do with this zucking? Zucking means old man, but I don't know in what sense. It can be a zucking in a critical sense, like he's an old man already. Or zucking is also a chacham, a term for a chacham. I'm not sure. We'll just leave it as it is. So God said, I will order him, go and marry a harlot and beget the children of harlotry. And then I will order him, send her away from my presence. If he will be able to send her away, so will I too send Israel away. For it is said, now they quote from, they're bolstering their interpretation. Because it says, and the Lord said unto Hosea, go take unto thee a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry. And it is written, so he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. And Gomer, Rav said, that implies that all satisfy their lust. Gomer, to complete on her. The daughter of Divlayim, Deborah. That means bad reputation. Deba, people speak, Ra. Bas Deborah, a daughter of bad reputation. O Shmuel Amar Shematuka Bafiakol, Kedibla. Shmuel interprets it in a different way, that she was sweet in everyone's mouth as figs, a cake of figs. I'm going to continue to read just to establish the context. While Rabbi Yochanan interpreted it, it means that all trod upon her, to tread on someone, like a cake of figs is trodden. Another interpretation, Gomer, well you see from this, why do you need so many interpretations? You see that they're not satisfied. The Torah is Chachman, you just keep going. If you see a different implication, you bring out another implication. It's part of the Chachma of the Kippei HaKodesh. Another interpretation, Gomer Rav Yehuda said, they desired to destroy Ligamer. Because again, the word, that's the beauty of Hebrew, that one word has so many different implications. And the Gemara is pointing out that the different aspects is brought out. Different aspect is brought out by the choice of the word. The wealth, they desired to destroy the wealth of Israel in her days. And Rabbi Yochanan says they did indeed despoil their wealth. Despoil. For it is said, for the king of Aram destroyed them and made them like dust in threshing. Alright, but that's a side point. Now the Gemara continues with the story. That is, so he married her, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said unto him, call his name Yisrael, for yet a little while, and I will visit the blood of Yisrael upon the house of Yehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Yisrael. He has three children with her. Each one has its own name, and the name has significance. Then it says that she conceived again and bore a daughter. And he said unto him, call her name Lo Ruchama. Ruchama means mercy. Lo Ruchama. That is not an object of mercy. Or not deserving of mercy. Or will not receive mercy. So the pasuk continues that God said, call her name Lo Ruchama. Has not obtained compassion. For I will no more have compassion on the house of Israel. that I should in any way pardon them. Because that's another idea. And she conceived and bore a son. That's the third child. And Hashem said, call his name Lo Ami, not my people. For ye are not my people, and I will not be yours. Well, here, it seems that God is pretty much saying the same thing that Hosea said. Lo Ami, they're not my people. And yet, when according to the Gemara, that's what Hosea was saying. If they rebelled against you, so dispose of them. Here God is saying to call the third one Lo Ami, not my people. After two sons and one daughter were born to him, the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Hosea, should you have not learned from your teacher Moses, Moshe? For as soon as I spoke with him, he parted from his wife. So do you too part from us. So God is saying to part from us. Sovereign of the universe, pleaded he, that's Hosea, I have children by her, and I can neither expel her nor divorce her. Said the Holy One, blessed be He, to him, then if thou, whose wife is a harlot, and thy children are the children of harlotry, and thou knowest not whether they are thine or they belong to others, yet thou art so, then Israel, who are my children, the children of my tried ones, the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, one of the four possessions which I have acquired in this world. Now, in parentheses, the Torah is one possession, because it says, Hashem Kanani Reshis Darko, the Lord acquired me as the beginning of His way. Heaven and earth is a possession, as it is written, God Most High, who possesses heaven and earth, Kone Shemayim Baretz, that's in Bereshis. The temple is one possession, for it is written, this mountain, that is the temple mount, which His right hand has acquired. Israel is one possession, for it is written, this people that you have acquired, that you've gotten. Now, of course, that's very interesting. What does that mean when it refers to particulars as being possessions? Of course, the whole world is God's. So everything is God's possession. Okay, fine. Nevertheless, God is saying to him, continuing the thought, that if you can't send away this woman who's a harlot, and the children of harlotry, you don't even know if they're your children or not, and you want me to send away the Jewish people who are my children, the children of my tried ones, the children of Abraham, Israel, and Yaakov, and one of the four possessions, yet thou sayest, exchange them for a different people? As soon as he perceived that he had sinned, up until this point Hosea apparently didn't realize that he had sinned, he arose to supplicate mercy for himself. Said the Holy One, blessed be He, to him, instead of supplicating mercy for thyself, supplicate mercy for Israel, against whom I have decreed three decrees because of thee. Thereupon he arose and begged for mercy, and he annulled the decrees. Then he began to bless them. See, this is the intro to the second. The Haftorah is the second one. Without this, you wouldn't have the background. Because it starts off, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea. That's how it starts off. That the number of the children of Israel will be like the dust of the sand of the sea, which can't be counted. And it shall come to pass that instead of that which was said unto them, you are not... Here's the significance of the Lo Ami. Instead of it being Lo, not my people, it shall be said unto them, you are the children of the living God. And the children of Yehuda and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and I will sow her into me in the land. That's Yisrael. That's the name Yisrael. The idea that they'll be planted in the land. And I will have compassion upon her that hath not obtained compassion. Ah, so that's all these three negatives will be changed into positives. Instead of lo ruchama, not worthy of compassion, I will have compassion. And I will say to them that were not my people, thou art my people. That is the background for the Haftarah, which is chapter 2. There's many, many questions in terms of what's the idea, what motivated Hosea to say it, and what was the idea of God putting him into this situation. It doesn't seem... okay, so that's an emotion. What does he learn from that? Then he realized that he had sinned. But that would seem to be an emotion. That he married this woman, he had the children, so it's very difficult to separate. But that's not the same thing as God. How does God say, well, now, so to speak, like, now you understand. Well, there's an analogy. There's an analogy over here. And besides, all the ideas, there's many, many ideas in this Haftarah. This whole idea of harlotry has tremendous signification. The Kikayon, it seems, at least superficially, it seems similar to the case of Yonah, who did not want to go on the mission. It was a different mission. It's ironic. There Yonah, it would seem, was protective of the Jews. He didn't want... apparently, it would be bad for the Jews if the people of Nineveh would do tshuva. Then it would make the Jews look bad. They did tshuva. So he was protective of the Jews. And he wanted Nineveh to be destroyed. And God, in order to instruct him, put him in a certain situation. That he... couldn't take the sun, and God produced the gourd, the kikayon, and then when it was removed, he was very, very sorrowful, and God made it's similar, like you care about the kikayon, and so on and so forth, it's here today, gone tomorrow. It's not identical, because God is not making an argument that the people of Nineveh